Our sponsor today is none other than our Patreon members. You folks are bringing swords and HEMA to listeners worldwide, so thank you. To support our work and receive exclusive benefits, visit patreon.com/swordwomen. Welcome to By the Sword, where we discuss the modern study of historical European martial arts, or HEMA, with instructors, experts, and martial artists from all over the world. This episode is an interview with sword maker Mark Howland of Shrike's Forge in Southern Oregon, USA. We discuss his beginnings in the SCA, how he began his crafts as a sword maker, and the more obscure and undiscovered areas of HEMA. The episode was recorded on Instagram Live, 12 September 2021. Hello! So today my guest is Mark Howland of Shrike's Forge in Southern Oregon, USA. Welcome, Mark.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. So let's start out. We've got all the heart reacts coming out now. All your pals are in the audience there. So let's start out. Got a lot of love. You are an SCA and a HEMA fencer. Tell me how you got into swords.
So this is just like, it came out of left field when I was about 20 or so. So about 7-8 years ago. I was just walking through a park and I saw a whole group in pretty much full armor fighting with live steel, not non-edge, just blunted, but like the steel trainers. And I was on a date at the time. And so I just like had to like stop for a second, be like, hold up, I got to watch this. And I started watching my local SCA group going at it. They approached me. They're like, hey, I see you guys, you know, kind of staring. Are you guys interested in this? And I want to be like, yeah, no, absolutely. And from there, it just kind of took off. They threw me in armor and gave me a quick rundown on their basic techniques and just started doing some slow work and some sparring day one. And from there, it's just been a constant form of just therapy, essentially, for me every day of my life since then.
When was that?
This was about 7 years ago, so we're looking like 2014 or so.
And did you go on another date with this person after this?
They weren't so interested, so I didn't wind up getting a second out of that, but I feel like I still came out of that with a very valuable asset.
You got the swords.
You don't need much. You don't need much.
You were distracted by swords. Oh, that's really cool. So, and HEMA, so that was the SCA folks were practicing in the park. They enticed you in, you got hooked. And how did the HEMA come out of that? Were they doing HEMA as well? Or?
So HEMA's not huge in Southern Oregon. So we're right in between two big points. Like there's two big schools in Portland, I believe, in Northern Oregon, and I think there's a couple of big schools in like Sacramento, California. We're right smack dab in the middle, so usually people go up north or they go down south. So I didn't get into HEMA for a couple of years afterwards, but there's a lot of comparison between SCA fighting and HEMA fighting at the time. And I got most recently introduced to HEMA due to some friends up in Portland, and they've actually been a really big proponent in me expanding into more HEMA type learning and basing what I make to HEMA practitioners. And so I really got into actual HEMA sort of communities just in the past year or two. And I haven't had too many opportunities to actually like practice with any clubs yet, because we just don't have them close by. Mm-hmm. But hopefully that's going to change soon. Hoping it'll change soon.
So someone on the outside looking in at the sword community as a whole, they kind of see us as this big, enormous, amorphous group of people who play with swords, which is fair. What would you say is the key differences between the SCA and HEMA?
So far, from my perspective, the people in the HEMA community I talk to are pretty, both feet are in both worlds a little bit, so I get kind of this like in between. But from my perspective, I've seen that the SCA is very much about the look. It's about recreating the entirety of medieval life around it, and just so happens that swords is a big portion of it. The martial aspect of it is a huge portion of it. Whereas I feel like with HEMA, it definitely comes down to more of a traditional martial arts sort of look at it. And there's still a lot of respect for the historical aspect of it. Like, I mean, the people I know that can essentially recite from the books and the plates and stuff like that, and know exactly how like some of the old like masters would like have placed footing and stuff like that. Like, it's immense. But that's kind of where like the line gets drawn, I feel like, between SCA and HEMA, is one is like really recreating the whole experience, and one of it is recreating this facet.
So yeah, one is about the breadth and one is about the depth. I guess.
Just
Like
how
that
much
one
people know about this
particular
one
thing.
subject.
Yeah, that one particular strand of it, but in way more detail. My next question, sorry, that's my dog scratching at the door. My next question would be, how did you get into making swords?
It kind of came apart with still there?
I'm listening. Keep talking.
Okay. It kind of came in the same sort of way that I found the SCA. There was a practitioner who was at those sparring practices in my early SCA career, that had started his own business. This is Sam Kovic. He actually owns Castile Armory,
Oh, yes.
and he picked me up really early on. And that was my introduction into sword making. Like, it was right away getting jumped in. I started working on some guards and stuff for him, just kind of cleaning up, doing basic processes. And, since I was local to him, and I had a background in art and mechanics and fabricating, so it was kind of a good fit. Ever since then, I kind of like started flourishing in that environment, and I just started picking up more and more experience as I was working for Sam at Castile Armory.
Oh. So are you an employee?
I was working there for about 4.5, 5 years. As I started real low, just doing some of the guards, and I progressed from there.
And when did you decide to do your own thing?
So it was about 3 years ago. I wound up having my grand ideas. I wanted to expand like what I wanted to do. And I was really looking for just moving into my like just my own little like niche almost. So I wound up finding another job and moving on, but I always had in the back of my mind that, well, I want to get back to this. And so I expanded. I wound up getting into like prosthetics, making medical prosthetics. After that, I got into doing fabrication for an automotive shop. I bounced around for a while, but through all of that, I was just slowly building up my tools for myself. And once I got to the point where I was comfortable, like, yeah, I've made a few things already, now I can start this business, I started Shrike's Forge early 2021.
Okay. So you haven't been going, you've only been going since the start of this year.
Yeah, with my own business.
As your own business, working for yourself, I'm guessing out of your own home.
It's out of a small shop right now that's on a residential area. But with the amount of growth that I've seen this year, I'm going to be looking at getting into a shop, professional, sort of area here soon.
And what's the most popular site? You said you've had a lot of growth. So
that implies that you've been selling a lot of things. What's the most popular item that you make and sell?
So I wound up having a big like group of people. They all like had seen my stuff, and I've had a lot of people vouching for me, like, hey, this is good stuff, get into it. And so there's about 7 or 8 basket hilted broadswords that I'm doing, all in kind of a Highland sort of style, so Jacobite and stuff like that. And there's 6 or 7 of those that I'm working on right now, and that's by far like leaps and bounds ahead of all the other swords I'm working on right now.
Mm. Have you got anything you want to show us?
I do, actually. And this is, there's a guy in the comments, Javen Mays. This is actually his sword, and he's going to love this.
Oh, Javen says, Mark's swords are stunning, and I'll be a lifelong customer. So let's see why. Let's see what prompted that.
So this is a basket-hilted mortuary with a flamberge blade on it. It's measuring 34 inches long.
Wow.
So here's the whole of it. And it's based on an extant example that I was shown by the customer. It's a pretty tapered blade with kind of a snake-like wave to it and a central fuller. And, here's the basket. It's a really like simple sort of, elegant mortuary shape with some of my own custom detailing in it.
I know flamberge blades appear on just about every weapon. Are there examples of mortuary hilts with a flamberge in existence? Or is it just this is what the person wanted, that's what they get?
Sadly, I'm not much of an expert on what extant examples there are of that, but to my knowledge, it wouldn't be unheard of to see a flamberge type broadsword blade on a mortuary hilt. I think the customer wound up actually finding an example he wanted to get really close to.
Oh, he says here, yes, it was based on an example. I remember doing a little bit of research a while back on flamberge blades, that they appear in just about everything. But I think they're just they're just cool, aren't they? It's like, ooh, everyone's like, yeah, yeah, I want a flamberge. Like, even now, I want.
Yeah, it was just the trend, the fad at the time, and everyone had to have one, you know?
Yeah, and people like ask me, like, is the flamberge, does it cut better? Does it, you know, does it have an advantage and all this kind of stuff? And I'm, you know, looking at like the fact that they turn up everywhere, but they're not like prevalent, I have to go with the concept that the flamberge is just cool. You know, it's, like, it's just a thing that is really cool. It's like, it's just a really nice aesthetic thing to have. It's not necessarily, you wouldn't have it for a practical reason, other than it's really fancy. Oh, Javen says it changes the feel of the engagement. I don't doubt that. And the slides, I've met a guy who had a flamberge rapier and dagger set, and you can definitely like you feel it in your bones when you're fencing one of those.
Yeah, you get more of a catch, more of an engagement with the blade and everything.
It goes right through you. So that is gorgeous. And that's a custom piece, is it?
Yeah. So a lot of what I do is just straight up custom work.
Right.
That's one of my favorite aspects of this profession, is that I really base it off of what the customer wants first. Mm-hmm. And I don't have too many stock blades.
Right.
And a lot of what I do is more one-off. Mm-hmm. It just so happens that a lot of people have a lot of ideas, and a lot of them just can't be narrowed down into one single version of it.
So how long would it take, like that one you just showed us, how long would it take start to finish from the customer ordering it to getting it in their hands?
From the customer ordering it to getting in their hands, this one's an interesting one because it's coming with a bunch of other pieces. But this one took a couple of months of just planning it out, designing it, getting all the parts together. And then the construction generally can move pretty quickly if that's the only thing I'm focusing on at the time. So it's probably a 2-month process if things are running smoothly.
That's pretty good. I I remember like the tight, like when Danelli and I've forgotten his name, our Polish guy, you'd have to book your slot like years in advance to get your sword.
Yeah, well, having just started, I didn't have much of a backlog.
Yeah.
And now I'm kind of getting to that point where, like, I'm getting that backlog, and it's kind of growing pains with first year stuff.
It's a nice problem and having, to have, I guess.
Yeah, it's not a bad problem, but it definitely is a stressful problem because it's like, oh, I promised this at this point, but due to whatever constraints wind up coming up, I have to talk to the customers pretty often about where they're at in the process.
So what was the first thing that you ever made?
The first thing I ever made? Are you talking for my business or as a an employee for Casting Armory?
Yes.
Fair enough. So the first thing I made for Castile Armory, it was kind of a personal weapon for me. It was the first complete blade that I had done start to finish all my own. And I wound up taking some scrap rapier Poppenheimer bits. So we had already had them pre-cut out and everything. And I started like playing around with engraving on it and had this fun thing, and it had like this really deformed skull on one side and like this weird cat dragon thing on the other, because we did customs that had odd stuff going on at the time. And I built that, and I wound up taking kind of a scrap blade. It was one of the first blades I've ever ground or worked on. And it, the spine was all wavy and everything like that, but it was sufficient for me to be able to use as a sparring blade for myself. And so that was one of the first ones. Sadly, I don't have it with me anymore. It wound up getting turned into a loaner sword for a local club. But one of the first things I made as a Shrike's Forge was one of my favorite bits that I'm still kind of refining is a Georgian Kamali.
Oh, yes. We're going to come on to
And it was one of the first things I made, like coming right out of the gate for Shrike's Forge. I'd been working with a guy named Mike Cherba. He's based out of the Northern Oregon, Portland, Salem area. And he's been trying to find someone who can do a really good reproduction of a Georgian Kamali. And so we spent months just refining down all the features and all the details of the Kamali into what could be a really good early period version of one for sparring.
So just, have you got one with you?
I have a blade of one with me. It's still in the process. I don't have everything for it quite yet, but I can show you that.
Yeah, so just describe to us what the Georgian Kamali is. Is it a single-handed curved?
It is a single-handed, but it is straight-bladed. Right. Let's see, where did I put it? It's not this one. It's not this one. If you will hold on for one second, I know exactly where it is.
We've got plenty of time.
Okay.
While Mark is looking, this is a perfect time for me to chat to you folks at home and say if you'd like to ask Mark anything about making swords, about the SCA, about HEMA, just drop us a question at the bottom of your screen. There is a speech bubble with a question mark in it. Just hit that button and type your question in there, and we will open it up and we will read it out.
All right, you got the Kamali blade.
Yeah.
For those of you who can see, it's a pretty straight blade.
Oh, wow.
That we generally go with. It's single edged. It doesn't have much taper and has a really gentle curve towards the tip. It's just a hidden tang sort of construction. But how I have it set up is one very big, broad fuller across the width. And then for sparring versions, I essentially do a second one that kind of runs right next to it and gives it a nice swelled edge so that, in sparring, it doesn't chew up the edge that bad.
Damn. What's the guard like? Has it got am I right in thinking it's got a knuckle bow?
These versions that I'm making right now, they're generally a very short cross guard. They only measure like 2 or 3 inches away from the center of the blade. And so they're not necessarily meant to protect your hand very well,
right?
By themselves, but they're generally used in conjunction with a small buckler of sorts. So you'll be fighting a lot with your hands very close together. I've seen it similar to some I-33. Well, you will capture an opponent's blade and then move in with another cut or something following up. I'm not a practitioner in a big sense with that, but the man who I worked on these with, he is. And so he told me how it should work.
We'll come on to that in a bit when we talk about your next sort of personal plans. So who are your creative influences when it comes to sword making? You said you started out at Castile. That was where you cut your teeth. Who, you know, is there anyone else that kind of inspires you when you're creating swords, or does it all just are there any sort of like historical weapons that really grasp your imagination and make you want to make more of those?
Gotcha. I have a lot of different influences, and that kind of comes from everywhere. I mean, starting with the actual makers, Dinelli was actually a huge one moving forward, because it was comparable to the stuff that I was working with at Castile. Not to mention that Castile, like Sam Kovic's whole vision and how he built stuff, is a major influence on how I move forward, because it's been my basis. So between him and Dinelli, Albion's had some influence. Their line of museum quality swords have been like a standard that I try and like push myself towards for a long time. I view them as kind of like, if I can get there, it's going to turn out looking pretty good. But a lot of like the makers that I see now, like I really look at their quality. But in terms of design, I do look at a lot of historical sources, but one of my favorite things is taking some of the fantasy sources and trying to meld the two. So there was, I think, a guy from New Zealand who did the Lord of the Rings swords. He actually created them right then and there and came up with all the designs, and a lot of those influence my designs moving forward. I mean, and then of course you got the literary stuff like Conan and Wheel of Time and all that stuff that I take little bits from all those sort of fantasy things and try and incorporate that bit of whimsy and fantasy in a lot of my designs. Because the historical stuff is great. I love it. And it is all very much like something to attain, but coming from an artist sort of background, being able to add in those little bit of aesthetics that tie it together has been a huge like balancing act for me that I love trying to hit.
Yeah, there's the authenticity and there's the creativity, isn't there? There's trying to get that. I mean, I know some people are like, you must be historically accurate as possible kind of thing. Like it must be an absolute replica of the things because that's how things were. But then you think, well, all these artisans and craftspeople were making stuff. They were creating things. They weren't following a blueprint. I mean, obviously, there's a kind of like, this is what Skidmona's like. But they have variety. There is, you know, there's creativity there. They didn't just like stamp things out, you know, all looking the same. Like, I'm thinking about like the 18th, the 19th century sabers that officers would have. It was you know, there was so much variety between those, and people, you know, there were standard patterns, but people wanted them to be their own. They wanted their literally to have their own stamp on stuff, like both the customer and of course the sword maker. It's not just a case of replicating what's gone before it. You have to have fun with it.
Yeah,
put a bit of your soul.
And that's one of my, and I totally agree. Like having some of that creativity within the realm of possibility is something that I enjoy finding. Like one of my big influences that I'm now thinking about is a lot of the Wallace Collection swords, like those rapiers. Those are insane. I couldn't make those now if I wanted to, because they have so much whimsy about them, and they're historical. They came out of the time period. Whether or not they were used is up for debate, but like some of those where it looks like actual chain was used for the guard or rope, like just turning those sort of fantastical elements into what we use as a martial tool is really inspiring. I've been able to make a few reproductions of some of those, and like just the amount of detail and whimsy that goes into those is mind-boggling.
Quick question here. I'm going to get up from my seat, but do feel free to just keep talking. Question here from I can't pronounce this. Oduabid Dioma. Have you thought about doing any Carolingian swords?
I'm actually not familiar. If I had a reference, but I mean, I don't have any sort of like visual about what those ones were. Wish it did now.
Okay, coming right back. Sorry, my kid's not controlling the pupper.
That's okay.
So Carolingian swords are not something that we've looked into yet. But we are going to talk in a minute about the more obscure weapons and the more obscure fighting styles in history. My next question for you, Mark, is what is the most, similar to my last interview that I had here with Stephanie last Sunday, was what's the most underestimated part of the job being a blade maker?
I think the most underestimated part of this job is I think just how much brain power it takes to wrap your head around what you're doing. So like I did this for a long time professionally for another company, but being on your own and designing these solely on your own, it takes a lot of just mental strength to go through this. And that I think is probably one of the biggest things that people underestimate. It's not just throwing some metal together. It's going down to the wire in terms of your material science, making sure that the steels that you're using are going to work for your application, as well as like your design elements. Like you have to figure out how this whole thing is going to come together into one piece, and it has to feel like it was all supposed to be there. And I think that is the hardest and most underestimated portion of this. It's not throwing some steel together with some grinds on it. It's really trying to create a singular piece.
That's all of the processes, all of the elements, all of the energy, mental energy it takes out of you to create and make something.
Yeah, it would be like, I'd say like making a cake. You can measure out cups and cups of flour all day long without really worrying about it. And so if that's the only thing you're doing, fine, you're good. You don't have to worry about anything else, but you have to figure out how everything's going to react to have it come out into one usable piece. Mm. And that's been how I've been thinking about it. It's like, I'm not just the guy shoveling flour. I'm not just the guy measuring out these things. I'm the guy who has to figure out how it works.
Yeah. The whole thing from start to finish, every single tiny step of the way. And what would be, well, some mentioned Carolingian swords. Javen Mays says they're like Viking swords. But what would be the dream sword to make that you'd love someone to ask you to do? Like, have a look, honey, Mark, make me this.
So this is going to kind of touch on like how I got started with Shrike's Forge. Is there's a lot of Eastern European and Middle Eastern swords that are the most gaudy, like well-embellished pieces of art I've ever seen in my entire life. They have gold inlay and filigree up and down the blade. And so I think one of my favorite, like, I want someone to ask this of me at some point would be to take one of those with as many bullet points and specifications as they want, and then tell me, have fun with the artwork on it and give it as much as you could. Because at this point in time, I can do cool designs on swords and like have them like come out really nice and basic, but taking one of those and then just embellishing it to a T, like just every inch of it has some artistic purpose. I think that would be the funnest thing in the world for me, just because I love doing the art of it and I love making it all fit together and cool construction and all that stuff. So I think it would probably be a Kamali or another Middle Eastern sword that I wind up just getting to go like full jeweler on it.
And you've done other sort of, you've been down other creative avenues like prosthetics and engineering and stuff. So do you think you might, like, I know you've got a lot on your plate at the moment, but do you think you might possibly branch out into things like, you said you like doing all the embellishment and stuff. A lot of sword makers, they do scabbards and things like that and sword belts. Is that something you think you might get into at some point?
I've done a few scabbards before and a bit of leather working on the side. It's not my forte, but it's something I love learning about. And so one thing moving forward is I have done a Japanese style katana that was like my first like kind of foray into like doing a full like scabbard and belts and all the fancy fittings and stuff. That was a really fun experience. And so I do think at some point I am going to expand into doing all of the furniture that goes with swords too. I mean, there's a lot of good makers out there that do that, but I feel like I can put my sort of thoughts and ideas into that and come up with something new as well. So at some point I'll do it.
Yeah. So let's talk about, come back to HEMA a minute. Cause I know, like, speaking to you in private before, that you're looking to branch out as if you're not busy enough. you obviously don't have enough to do, but you want to be teaching HEMA, or maybe you already are, I don't know. You're looking to teach HEMA there in Southern Oregon, because you said that there's a dearth of HEMA in your location. It's mostly SCA. So tell us about your plans.
Yeah, so the SCA here is actually relatively healthy. We have a good amount of fighters who do SCA in its various forms of fighting. But we don't have HEMA clubs, like anyone that participates in HEMA tournaments or is really involved in that community. And I feel like we can get more out of the area that we're in if we have both of those available. So I'm not at a level right now where I could really teach someone that like all the finer points or anything like that. I would most likely be a student following along, but I want to help get that moving. I know a few people here in the Southern Oregon area that do have kind of the teaching chops to get it done. But like right now it's really just coming up with like the space to do it and getting the right people in to really move it forward. So that's the idea. I want to get it here. If it's not like a big stop on a HEMA tour or anything like that, that's okay. But as long as there's something here that we can have like that depth of focus, I feel like it's going to really help the community here.
You just need to set it up.
Yeah, I just need to set it up. I mean, at this point in time, I'm thinking about just like diving into a couple of different styles and just really hashing them out and like cross-referencing with like the clubs up in Portland and down in Sacramento and see where I fall with those instructors and see if, you know, maybe I can start getting something going down here.
Yeah, that'd be cool. And then we could put you on HEMA Alliance Club Finder and you can go, if you want to find a HEMA club, there you go. this is my shout out, by the way, to anyone who runs a HEMA club. Put yourself on the club finder, please, because people keep coming to me and saying I can't find a HEMA club, and I'm like, there's loads of HEMA clubs near you, there's nothing near me. And it turns out there are a few clubs near people, they're just not on the map. So put yourself on the map to save me hours of combing through Facebook trying to find these people. Put yourself on the map, literally put yourself on the map to save other people time trying to point you out, because I'm sending you students and they can't find you.
We're trying to grow the community, guys. Come on.
Come on, build the community. So, we've kind of hinted at your influences from working with Mike Cherba on the Georgian Kamali for several months. So that's the, one of the more obscure cultures in the HEMA sort of teaching sphere is Georgian sword and buckler. amongst other things. So tell us about that and tell us, you know, what inspired you. I mean, we joked earlier about, is it because it's just German longsword, Italian rapier, like, what else, you know, surely there's more to it than that.
That's one of the things that, like, even through the SCA, I always liked seeing the obscure sort of fighting styles or using the obscure weapons. Like, I never wanted to stick with just what everyone else was doing for the most efficient or that was the most well-rounded or anything. I liked going out and finding the weird stuff. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of, like, laid the groundwork for me moving forward. And then as I was starting to get things moving with my forge and getting some pieces just kind of set up, one of my friends who's friends with Mike Turbo wound up introducing me. And he's like, I know you can build this. He wanted me to build this trainer, but you got to understand, like, what it's for and how it's used. And so that introduced me to that fighting style. And it turns out that there's a very deep, deep well of knowledge about that very specific type of fighting style. So much so that there are some resources for that in some book forms. I don't have them right now in my head, but there are instructors out there, and this is actually a really recent technique style. They were using this sporadically, I think, up through like about 1950s, because that area is so closed off from the rest of the world. They developed this very particular fighting style, and I heard stories about them, like, using this in about the 1950s through duels and stuff like that. So it's a really modern, it's not modern, but it's come up right to modern day, and it has hundreds of years of history behind it. Mm. So if we have that much with German longsword or Italian rapier or Spanish or anything like that from the well-known stuff, what about all these other smaller communities with rich, deep histories where they develop their entire own fighting style separate? And how effective would they be against, you know, the main stuff? And, like, there's lots of stories about, like, people who tried doing conquest through the area, and yeah, sure, they would get taken over, but they would really respect the fighters there. So they had to have something going for them through that. So it's just, like, it got my gears turning, like, wanted to see what this was like. And so it's kind of got me on the path of, let's find these more obscure fighting styles that have been passed on from generation to generation and see how they work against the stuff that we're using nowadays.
It would be really cool to see more of that. I mean, when you think of sword and buckler, you think of, like, 133, like, the oldest text that we have, literally the oldest fighting manual that we have. And yet there were people doing sword and buckler in the 1950s in, you know, little Georgia. I've seen photos of it. They got, like, they have their helmets and they have chainmail, like, from head to toe. I think they had, like, obscure rules about the posture and, like, being on one knee or something like that. A bit like SEA, I don't know. But it's a really, you know, it's a very interesting and because it's well documented, like you say, both in photography, and it's literally there are people who know how to fight like this. It's not something that's just died off or only been recorded in a manual somewhere. It's something that's really worth exploring. It's just, like you say, it's just so, you know, obscure and little, you know, it's one of those little rocks that hasn't quite been turned over and explored yet. Just checking, no one's come put any comments in here. So yeah, is that something that you think you might end up teaching yourself, or are you just interested in, like, getting, you know, folks together and setting it up, or how's that
going to go? So while building the Kamalis, these, you know, Eastern European sabers, I've had to fight in the style a little bit. I'm by no means an expert. I know the barest little minimum that I need just to get the posturing correct. And even then, it's not great. I do believe that I'm probably going to move forward in this because I've seen the merits of the style. It can be a very aggressive style. It can be a very effective style, especially in certain situations that I've seen. And I think it has a lot of merit going up against some of these other styles and, like, say, tournament settings, too. It could be something that comes out of a niche. And even though it might not be everyone's culture or everyone's forte, it still can very well be a driving force in, like, kind of expanding, learning these different styles that you don't have to be relegated to this. And I think that's where I'm at, where I want to learn this, so that I can show other people, so that I can kind of drive it. And then hopefully inspire more people to go out and find these other cultures that have a very deep history of fighting that just has developed separately from what we know.
I mean, it certainly helped, you know, loads of folks study Sword and Buckler. It certainly helped their understanding to see a more recent living style of fencing that is very similar to what they were already studying.
And that's a good point as well. Just maybe we'll understand the understanding of I-33 better because of it.
Exactly.
I like that. I like that approach.
I mean, we talk about frog DNA, you know, filling in the gaps to try and understand something better. But I mean, nothing develops in a vacuum, I suppose. I mean, it's just continuously been practiced all that time, it must have links back to, you know, previous iterations of sword and buckler fighting. You know, it's not that geographically distant. What was it when you were going through this stuff with Mike? What was it, you know, was there a moment there when you were practicing the stuff where you thought this could be a thing, like, rather than just purely going through it?
So I was kind of given a couple of videos from him, like, we weren't able to physically meet at the time, but I had built the prototype and I wound up getting it to spec. You know, I was able to kind of show where the balance was, show where the weight was. I even, like, found the center of percussion and all that. And then, like, got it put in my hand, and then he showed me a couple of videos that I should watch and try and emulate. And going through some of the motions, I'm like, okay, cool. I think I got this. And so I kind of practiced that for a little while. And so that kind of got my grounding for it. And then there was one time, it was relatively recently, he came down for a small little, like, HEMA sort of fight practice that we wound up putting on. And he showed me exactly what he was doing physically in front of me. And we wound up pairing off. I made a couple of Kamalis at the time, and he had a couple of bucklers. So we got geared up, and we started just kind of going lightly at first. And just how quickly and succinctly he took my guard apart kind of showed that, oh, there's something to this that I'm not getting. And so we worked on it quite a bit through that day. And at the end of the day, I'm like, I can understand the process. And once I got that understanding, like, ah, this can be efficient. This can be good. This could work for me because it makes sense. At least with the style of fighting there, or like the environment that I was in. And it's just like, okay, cool. This makes sense. I can use it. And it worked for me. It worked in my, for my body and all that. So it was just like getting shown that first time and then showing how effective it can be has been a really, like, big eye opener to the style.
Well, I'll keep an eye on it, Mark. I hope you get somewhere with this. It really deserves more recognition and more brain power to sort of interpret and practice all of this stuff. So we're gonna wind it up in just a minute, but I want to ask you, what's the biggest challenge of your work?
The biggest challenge, I mean, besides just trying to get everything put together, has really been like some of the more fine details when it comes to the manufacturing process. So far, I've been doing everything old school, like charcoal, forge, charcoal, everything, just to try and, like, get myself going as best as possible. Thankfully, I've been able to come out with some really good stuff. A lot of materials are amazing and they give you a lot of leeway. You could have taken my process and given it to someone 400 or 500 years ago and they'd be like, oh yeah, I did that. So I started from like literally a pit in the ground with charcoal and some air running through it. Wow. And that has been a difficult process to try and nail down. Thankfully, I
feel self then.
Yeah, it's really difficult, and it wound up being a huge sort of like monument to like my self-esteem when I wound up being able to get the right specs for the heat treat and everything. Thankfully, I have a piece of machinery coming in here soon, and before the end of the year, I will have this heat treat oven in which I can get the exact thing I'm looking for every time. My consistency is going to come back up. But that's been the biggest hurdle, is just making sure that my heat treat and everything is safe, everything is usable and durable. You know, as much as like trying to recreate things is a huge part of trying to understand historical like martial arts, there comes a point when modern facilities really elevate that.
You're like, okay, I've done that now. On to the modern stuff. And what would you, final question, what would your advice be for someone new to this who wants to become a bladesmith?
I think my advice would be let yourself feel daunted by it. Let yourself feel like this is a lot, but just take the little steps at it. You know, and if you do want it to go, you know, go big, you want to make swords. Don't limit yourself to spending so many hours making nails in your forge first. Don't limit yourself to only making knives for a while. Mm-hmm. Go ahead and take the big risks to do it and learn from them as much as possible. So far, my best accomplishments have come from when I thought that I'd ruined something and I just wasn't going to move on with it. But I wound up, I picked the piece up and I tried again. And my biggest accomplishments and the most I've learned has always come from me taking my mistake and figuring out what I did wrong with it and fixing it. Not learning from a manual, not learning from a book. It's always been, how am I understanding it and how am I fixing it? And that's my biggest thing, is just allow yourself to make mistakes, go for the big stuff, and, you know, just allow yourself to make those mistakes.
Great life advice as well. Take risks, make mistakes, learn from them, do better. Okay, thank you so much, Mark Howland, Shrikes Forge. It's been lovely speaking to you. Thank you for coming on the show.
Of course. Thank you for having me. This has been wonderful.
You're very welcome. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. To show your appreciation, please give us a 5-star review on your podcast platform, or support our work by becoming a patron at patreon.com/swordwomen. Go to @swordwomen on Instagram to see upcoming interviews, or visit buythesword.net to learn about our events, or visit our Facebook page, By the Sword.